Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio in Fresno and Bakersfield, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, when the city of Fresno closed down several large homeless encampments, where did the people living there go? FM 89's Rebecca Plevin reports on one woman who now has a home and another who is still living on the streets. We'll also talk with New York Times columnist Timothy Egan, author of the award-winning book The Worst Hard Time, the story of those who lived through the Dust Bowl. Later in the show, we'll hear a special report about California's three strikes and you're outlaw. It's been a year since voters loosened some provisions of the controversial sentencing law. Michael Montgomery reports on how those changes have worked out. That and another edition of our homegrown book club, with a new novel set in Bakersfield, written by an author from Dinuba. Those stories and more, up next on Valley Edition. But first, the news.
With these news headlines, I'm Ezra David Romero. California employers who rely on employees with science and engineering skills say they can't find enough qualified applicants. California educators are looking for ways to solve that problem, as Ben Adler reports from Sacramento.
I'm just shorting up this side because it kind of sticks out a little.
San Francisco 7th graders Caleb Leung and Scully Randlett are making a bridge out of white paper and scotch tape.
We started off with flat paper and we rolled it up with knitting needles.
It's going to be a full-size cantilever bridge that's a basic replica of the top half of the Bay Bridge.
The old Bay Bridge, that is. The new one's more complicated. Randlett says he's always been interested in making things, and this program at his school is helping him get some future job experience.
You might want to get a job as an engineer, and someone wants you to build a bridge across a creek or something, and you could go back to this and remember, oh yeah, the degree angles is 45 degrees for each one besides like the top two or something like that.
The paper bridge is one of a couple dozen exhibits at a two-day STEM symposium in Sacramento. STEM stands for science, technology, engineering, and math. State Superintendent of Public Instruction, Tom Torlakson.
So many companies are just searching for the talent and they're not finding it among our graduates. So we have an imperative really to improve our interest in science, keep it alive at an early young age so that those students will stay the course, take the hard math classes, take the science classes they need to become those future inventors.
The event is drawing some 2,000 educators, students, business leaders, and philanthropists. At the state capitol, I'm Ben Adler.
The California Budget Project has released a report detailing the effects of cuts to state child care and early education programs. The report says the state has cut child care and preschool services nearly 40% in the past 6 years. Hope Richardson co-authored the report. She says recent state budget cuts to programs like CalWORKs Child Care has had a big financial impact on low-income families.
There's reduced access for families who qualify for care and need that child care assistance in order to go back to work or work full-time in their jobs.
The report says the current budget has restored some funding, but the number of child care and state preschool slots is down 25% from the 2007-2008 levels. Again, Hope Richardson.
If you can't access child care assistance, you could be spending nearly half of your income sending your child to preschool while you work.
The report recommends raising the income eligibility limit for child care and state preschool and repealing the fee parents must pay for part-day state preschool. For Valley Public Radio News, I'm Ezra David Romero.
You're listening to Valley Edition. Last month, the city of Fresno destroyed a fourth homeless encampment in downtown near Palm and H Streets as a part of a crackdown on tent cities. But what happened to the people who were displaced? FM 89's Rebecca Plevin tracked down two homeless women who found starkly different living situations.
For almost a year, Nancy Holmes and Cinnamon Blake were neighbors in a homeless encampment in downtown Fresno. But city employees bulldozed their camp a few weeks ago in an effort to rid the city of illegal structures. the two friends and the other residents of their camp scattered.
I didn't particularly care for the patch that Cinnamon found us, but damn, we were safe.
Nancy and Cinnamon ended up on a huge, dusty piece of county land on the west side of Fresno. Nancy is 61, a borderline diabetic with arthritis. She lasted there for about 2 weeks.
You blow your nose in the morning and you got a mud puddle, you know?
Since then, Nancy and Cinnamon have taken separate paths toward survival. I met Nancy last week at a house on Dakota Avenue where she's lived for about a week now. The Dakota Eco Garden, as it's known, is the brainchild of local homeless advocates.
We have a nice big kitchen. She's doing laundry and Brad is here. He has his room.
Currently, two people live inside the home and one is in her tent on a raised platform in the backyard. A fourth is in a small eco-structure designed by architect Art Dyson that generates its own heat and air conditioning. The backyard has a huge fruit and vegetable garden. Homeless activist Nancy Waitlow owns the house.
I have high hopes for the people who live here eating a lot of the food from the garden, lettuce and eggplant and strawberries, I hope, next spring.
After living in a tent for almost a year, Nancy Holmes says she feels saved.
I can take a shower, I can wash my clothes, I can eat food and put my food in the refrigerator, and it's between heaven and hell. Hell is out there in the dirt.
For the first time in years, Nancy finally feels like she's back on solid ground.
I guess you could say living in a motel, you're homeless, but at least you have showers, and we had a little stove to cook on and things like that.
Before she landed on the streets, Nancy moved from motel to motel with her daughter and grandson.
My daughter's a prostitute, and I had food stamps and things that she would pay the rent and I would buy the food.
Years ago, she says, she cooked at area restaurants and hotels and then worked as a security guard at the Fresno Art Museum. She hasn't worked since 2006, when she lost her security job and later had two heart attacks. Today, she says, she's found a new calling. I ask her if she still considers herself homeless.
No, I consider myself a homeless advocate now, someone that's there to help.
She pauses and a smile comes over her face. We're sitting on lawn chairs, and she points toward a flower garden.
Oh, how sweet. Do you see him, the little hummingbird? Yeah. Oh, Cinnamon would love that.
The next day, I join Nancy and two homeless advocates to visit Cinnamon. The dusty field is a stark contrast to the eco garden. It doesn't look like a hummingbird or a human could survive here.
We're driving on private property next to the railroad and next to the railroad property.
Yeah, and this is like a big dist field.
Soon, Nancy spots the makeshift structure that she shared with Cinnamon and her dogs.
I'm just so excited to see Cinnamon. Cinnamon! Cinnamon!
Be cautious of the dogs. Oh, here they come. Hey, Sheba. I don't care. I always hug her wet.
I'm always sweating or something.
No, she's jumping in the canal or whatever.
Cinnamon had been in the nearby canal and was soaking wet. She met us at her camp, a sprawling structure that's ingeniously made from tarps and other found items. She's built a living room, kitchen, and bedroom.
This was out of view of the freeway and far away from the street. And, there's no, food max nearby. It's like out of the view of public, which is what the city seems to like be pushing so hard that they don't want to see us.
The location is remote, but it has a huge asset, running water. Cinnamon led us down to the canal. Then she waded into the water to scrub the dust off the fur of her biggest dog, Sheba.
Even if there was a nicer place, that had grass or, had some other thing going for it that this doesn't, I would pick this over it because running water is yeah, it's life.
Cinnamon says she's been homeless most of her life. She grew up relying on welfare, school lunches, and free snacks from rec centers.
A lot of times I didn't have my own room. I was a lot of memories of blanketless or sheetless bed, a mattress on the floor in the corner of a room, and about 8 or 12 other kids sleeping and sharing that bed.
Why then, I ask her, didn't she want to move into the eco garden with Nancy? One reason, she says, is she couldn't take all of her dogs, who she loves like daughters. She says she values freedom for herself and her dogs.
I didn't raise them like that to just sit in the corner or wait until I want them to fetch. I raised them to roam around and keep an eye on things and run and, like, be alive. And she don't have the space for that.
To an outsider, it might be tough to see Cinnamon living alone like this. But she says she's less likely to get raped, robbed, or jumped here than in other areas where the homeless stay.
It's safer out here than it is to sleep in the doorway of a business downtown. Or anywhere in town, actually. It's safer here than it is to sleep at Roding Park or River Park or Kearney Park. It's safer here than it is to be at any of the missions.
As we say goodbye, Nancy, Cinnamon, and the homeless advocates point out to me the taller buildings of downtown Fresno. They can make out the women's old encampment.
Their old home.
Where is it?
Straight through the trees.
These tracks lead straight to the
grain silos. Got chased out of.
It was a reminder that these women's homeless journeys could be long from over. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Rebecca Plevin.
And you're listening to Valley Edition. Rebecca Plevin joins us now in the studio for a follow-up discussion. Rebecca, I want to know more about the Eco House. This is an interesting concept. How did this come about?
Right. So I think the Eco House idea has been around for a while. It's been something that homeless advocates have wanted to initiate. And the woman that we heard from, Nancy Waitlow, finally, I think, got it going a couple of years ago. And she found a house on Dakota Avenue. And so now they have the house, they have the garden in the backyard, they have one eco shelter, and they're hoping to build a couple more.
So you have the regular home up front, you have the eco home that Art Dyson has been talking about for a while, sort of a template for it in the backyard. Is this a permanent solution for Nancy, or is this a transitional space for her?
So I think the house is supposed to be a transitional living space for people. You know, it allows them to get off the streets, have a steady place to sleep and to eat and to shower and hopefully begin to find some work. I think for Nancy, she's hoping to become the house manager. And so she was hoping to have a role there. And like you heard her say, she really wants to become a homeless advocate and help people the way that people have helped her.
Now, turning to Cinnamon's story, the interesting thing about her is she's still living in outdoors. She has her own camp set up in this vacant field. It's not in the city, though, anymore. So the city crews can't go after her. Is that the thinking?
That is the thinking when they pick this patch of land, is that it's a place where the city can't push them, keep pushing them off, because it is, as far as I understand, county land.
Now, homeless advocates certainly have been pushing for things like the Eco House for years. Is there a plan to expand this in any way? What are the folks behind this saying? How happy are they with the way it's turning out?
I think they are excited about what they have going on there. They're hoping to build, like I said, maybe 3 or 4 more eco homes in the backyard. They're at this point, I guess those eco homes take a little while to build, so they're also having people come in and building little platforms where people can put their tents out in the backyard. I think they're hoping that this could spur other ideas, you know, get community involved in other ways, maybe show the city and county that there are affordable ways to house people.
How did you see Nancy change? Because you reported on these two women a month ago when they were forced out of the H Street encampment. How did you see both of those women change just in their own personal
way? Yeah, that's right. I met Nancy and Cinnamon on the day that their homeless camp was being destroyed, and they were both very distraught at that time. They lived, you know, they were neighbors in this homeless encampment, and both of them were just so distraught. I mean, as you can imagine, their homes were being pushed down. They didn't know where they were going to go next. And when I met Nancy at this eco home, you know, she met me and you know, she looks clean and refreshed, and she offered me some coffee, you know, and she definitely seemed, I mean, you heard her say she feels saved. She says it's between heaven and hell. She just seemed completely different.
And Cinnamon, correct me if I'm wrong, but would you say that she's happy in this new spot? How would you assess her state in this new space that she's in?
You know, she seems like a woman who really values her freedom. You heard her say that about her dog. She taught them to roam around and be alive. And I think she has the same
desires for herself. She doesn't want to be in a house or in a program. She wants to be free. And so I think the place she is now, while it is really dusty and remote, she has that water there, and she maybe she is happy, you know? I mean, I think she's where she wants to be.
That's certainly a question only she can answer. But one last question. Right now, she's in a space where she has her camp set up. Are there other camps nearby?
Right. So it's a big, large field. And her, this sort of camp that she built for herself, she is sort of a standalone camp. And there are a couple other tents sort of nearby. So she's not completely alone out there, but she doesn't have – it's not tent next to tent next to tent like they were at the old encampment.
Valley Public Radio's Rebecca Plevin joining us today talking about the aftermath of the city of Fresno's effort to close down homeless encampments and the personal stories of two women who were displaced from those camps. Rebecca, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Joe.
You're listening to Valley Edition. Stay tuned. We'll be back in just a moment with a discussion and a report about California's three strikes law. It's been a year since California voters changed the law. What have been the ramifications of those changes? Michael Montgomery from KQED will join us. That's coming up in just a moment on Valley Edition. You're listening to Valley Edition. A little more than a year ago, Californians voted for Proposition 36, allowing the release of three strikers convicted of nonviolent, non-serious crimes. Since then, about 1,000 people have been released. KQED's Michael Montgomery followed three men as they left prison and adapted to their new lives outside, and interviewed multiple experts and stakeholders about the state's criminal justice system.
This time last year, thousands of state inmates serving life were suddenly faced with the possibility a local court might reduce their sentence and even grant them early release. Inmates like Robert Watts.
It's on my mind every day. I've been nervous ever since I heard I had a court date. Because it's like, I don't know, it's like you're either going home or you're stuck here for another 14 years, 15 years.
Watts was sent to prison for life in 1999 under the state's three strikes law. His crime? Receiving stolen property, a box of tools. Before that, he was in and out of prison for robbery and assault. He says those crimes were all part of his addiction to methamphetamine. We spoke on the yard at San Quentin Prison, where men were shooting hoops, playing tennis, and talking in small clusters. Watts told me he felt lucky to be at San Quentin because of the array of rehabilitation programs here. In fact, all those years behind bars had actually helped him clean up his act.
Sometimes you need a long time. It takes a long time for you to get the drugs out of your system. It takes a long time. When I got arrested, I was more relieved because now I'm out of the situation I'm in. It sounds stupid, but now I can relax because the drugs aren't there. I can't get them. I'm all right.
But 13 years was enough. Watts was ready to leave prison.
You got to look at the positive changes I made. I think I haven't just sat around and just went with the prison system. I tried to change. I did these programs, went to college. I tried to make an effort to change my way of thinking because my old way of thinking was wrong.
Because his third strike wasn't serious or violent, Watts could ask for resentencing and possibly get released. But, like thousands of other three strikers, his freedom wasn't guaranteed. Under Proposition 36, local prosecutors can challenge inmate petitions, and judges can block their release if they're deemed an unreasonable threat to public safety. I was interested in the Watts case because of where he was convicted. Kern County leads the state in three strikes convictions based on population. And what's more, local prosecutors there had vowed to challenge any petition for resentencing.
The only true way that I've seen so far to get people to stop committing crimes on career criminals like that is to lock them up.
Chief Deputy District Attorney Mark Pafford oversees three strikes cases for Kern County.
I guarantee that if they're locked up, and if Robert White is locked up, he's not going to be out robbing anybody's house or stealing their car or whatever. That's a guarantee.
A few weeks after I met Robert Watts at San Quentin, I spoke with his father, Tom. It was the day a judge was supposed to rule on his son's petition.
We're in front of the courthouse here in Kern County, in Bakersfield, California. I hope that the district attorney sees that Robert has done well, and the judge does too.
come to order. Department 15 is now in session.
Inside, during the hearing, Peter Kang of the Kern County Public Defender's Office talked about how well Robert Watts had done in the prison rehab programs. And he pointed out that it was a low-level crime that drew Watts a life sentence.
Mr. Watts was a co-defendant on a case where his co-defendant took two toolboxes, and for that he spent over a decade in prison for it. This is exactly the type of cases that the voters in California believe was too harsh. I think the academically honest and legal decision in this case would be to allow Mr. Watts to be resentenced.
The new law doesn't specify how to assess an inmate's record in these types of hearings. Do you just look at the last strike, or do you go further back? The deputy district attorney handling the Watts case, Alex Sawoya, cited his entire criminal career.
He's obtained four strike prior convictions before the age of 30. He hasn't been crime-free for any period of time. He's been in and out of jail or prison since 1987.
She pointed to evidence of marijuana use in prison and challenged claims that he was a changed man.
Your Honor, his parents, they mean well, but they're making excuses for him, blaming schools, teachers, even coaches for his bad behavior. He still has a lot of growing up to do, Your Honor. We'd ask the court to deny the motion and not resentence him and let him serve out the term that he was originally sentenced to.
After the hearing adjourned, his mother, Beverly Watts, sat on a bench outside the courtroom and cried.
That was very hard, but it's not like we've forgotten. It's not like we've forgotten. He did some terrible things, but he's also done some really good things to better himself. 13 years of good stuff.
For his part, Robert Watts tried to brush off the DA's comments, but they got under his skin. He got thinking about his mistakes as a kid, his crimes, and all the years behind bars. Watts was in cuffs and leg chains when we spoke at the county jail where he was transferred for the hearing.
It's not like I was trying to go out there and come up on a bunch of money. I was never making any money on these stupid crimes. It was just something stupid I was doing. I was high or something. And it wasn't like I was trying to rob a bank, come up with a lot of money, or rob somebody with a lot of money. It was just pizza man. It was stupid. But now I'm 41, it seems different.
Watts was braced for the court to deny his petition and send him back to San Quentin. Instead, the following week, he got some good news.
The court will rule that the people have not met their burden to show that Mr. Watts, if he is resentenced, would be a danger to public, safety.
The judge ruled he was not a threat to public safety. He reduced his sentence by 5 years. And because of time served, that meant Watts was eligible for release. We'll get back to his story later. Some of the three strikers who qualify under Prop 36 found an easier time in the courts. One of them is Richard Napoleon Brown. I met Brown in the chapel at San Quentin as he was rehearsing with a gospel group he'd formed behind bars.
Start singing as I was writing and putting a beat to it. And when I ran across these brothers in San Quentin, we established this group, and God brought us together for that purpose. And from that point on, we started presenting each other's originals and practicing on them.
Brown's case goes back to 1995, a year after voters approved the three strikes law. He was arrested when he tried to steal two car alarms from a local Walgreens store.
They took me down to the police department, and at that point they said, "Oh, you have two prior felonies. You're a three strikes candidate." I wasn't aware that they had implemented this three strike law. I heard about it, but I didn't think they would be that much out of control with the application of the sentencing guidelines.
Brown's prior felonies counted as his first two strikes, even though they dated back 20 years. His third strike was the shoplifting charge, and that exposed him to a 25-to-life sentence.
Horrible. It was devastating.
Vicki Delf is a San Joaquin County public defender who represented Brown.
I've been in the office about 5 years. I had done several felony jury trials, but never a three strikes case that went to trial, and never where it was on a petty theft.
That was 18 years ago. Brown is now 61 with a stellar prison record. When he petitioned for resentencing, Delph says the case sailed through.
It was very informal almost, and judge said no question, DA didn't oppose, bam, that's it.
In some ways, Richard Brown says that was the easy part.
After I got outside the doors of San Quentin, they told me I had to get off the premises. I said, well, is there a phone call, a phone booth around, anything? They said, nope, no phone booth. You have to leave. The point being is this. They give you $200 and they kick you out. And they don't give you any type of papers to indicate that, hey, you can go down to this program or you can go to this program.
Like Brown and Robert Watts, who we met earlier, most three strikers being released under Prop 36 reforms have served so much extra time that they're not placed on parole or probation. Often, that means they don't have access to housing, substance abuse and mental health support, and other programs. In some counties, prosecutors, public defenders, and legal aid groups are starting to develop support networks. In some places, former inmates are supporting each other. That's what Pete Marin is doing. I met up with him in Bakersfield as he was heading to meet his friend Eddie Alwell.
He's an older man. And I love doing whatever I can for him. It's a privilege and an honor that I even could do that.
Both Marin and Alwell served 18 years, one for petty theft, the other for drug possession, before they were resentenced and released. Alwell lives in a small apartment with his daughter and six grandkids. He met them for the first time when he got out of prison earlier this year.
What's up, Eddie?
Hey, bud.
How you doing?
Doing good. What did you do?
No, what are you going to do?
Cool, come on.
Alwell is 65 and frail. Recently, he was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease.
Before I got busted, never had time for kids. I was living in a fast lane. And now, I'm like a nanny. You know? I cook for them, I wash for them, I watch over them. I mean, you know, sometimes I'm drove up the wall, but then I go in my room and pray for it a little bit, and I come out okay, you know what I mean?
You know, a lot of men that have done, that were sentenced under the three strikes, a lot of men have realized that their life before was bad, so to speak, or, you know, they were... They realize they grew up, basically, and they know that the life they were living was not good. I think some kind of programs to help them get on their feet and to lead them in the right way, and I think that'd be very important.
Many former three strikers are relying on support from family, if they have any. When Robert Watts was released, he called his dad from the local bus station. That's where prison guards left him late one night.
I just called my dad. My dad was like, who's this? And I said, yeah, they dropped me off at the Greyhound. He's all, no, they didn't. I was like, yeah. He's all, come get you right now. It was weird.
Watts spent a couple of anxious nights at his parents' home in Bakersfield. Then he moved north, looking for the kind of structure he'd known in prison. He was lucky to get into a transitional program in Berkeley.
Well, I just wanted to get up here because the Kern County is a bad spot. I wanted to get up here, get the program, because I wouldn't have too much downtime. I wanted to get right into a program so there'd be more of a flow.
Watts was struggling to find a job and was living on about $325 a month. Richard Brown did find work. After his abrupt release from San Quentin, he settled in Ripon, a small farming community south of Stockton. In Ripon, he got a job at a company that assembles agricultural machinery.
These are called orders, and we're making it for the farm workers. You know, we construct and design the machines there in order for the farm workers to take care of their crops.
Brown was encouraged to come here by local farmers, Minard and Vivian Rorda. A neighbor had told them about his case 18 years ago. They drew close to Brown, and over the years they visited him many times in prison.
We could see the merits of the three strikes for outlaw. But at the same time, are we not and are they not deserved a second chance? Are they not deserving of our help? Are they not deserving of our love?
In Ripon, they struggled to help find Brown a place to live.
We tried to find a place and spending time trying to find something that was affordable. We finally made application for a place here in Ripon, and it took 10 days before we find out, oh, they do not want inmates.
Finally, a local family offered to rent Brown a house.
Rock of ages, Clairefort.
Turns out they were from the Ruritas Church, and from time to time, that's where Richard Brown and two new friends sing.
Let the water and the blood from thy wounded side which flowed.
Brown is reconnected with his daughter and discovered that he has grandchildren he never knew about. He wants to do more with his gospel music, maybe reunite with the group from San Quentin if the other men are released. He doesn't dwell on the many years he spent behind bars. Like Robert Watts and Pete Marin, Richard Brown says getting a life sentence was a miserable wake-up call and one that compelled him to turn his life around. But that only makes sense now as a free man.
Had you not gone to prison on such a long sentence, is there a chance you wouldn't be on the path that you're on?
It's a great possibility. I would have to say that. It's a great possibility. Because the road that I was down was and headed toward was the road to destruction.
What does that say to you about the three strikes law?
Well, I have to say this. Instead of me allowing bitterness to be a part of my life while I was incarcerated, I chose to want to benefit as much as I possibly could and can at the time out of it. So I never want to say that it was fair in the way they applied the law, but I benefited from it.
While I draw this fleeting breath, when my eyelids close in death, when I rise to worlds unknown, see the on
the... And Michael Montgomery from KQED joins us now on Valley Edition to talk more about the changes to three strikes. Michael, welcome.
Well, hi there. It's nice to be with you.
This is a very interesting story and so many things I want to talk about. Where are we, start out though in some of the numbers, where are we in this overall process? Around 1,000 people have been released in this resentencing program. What's the backlog like at this point and how is this playing out statewide?
So that's right. There's been over 1,000 releases since the proposition passed last year. That's out of an estimated 3,000 to 3,500 inmates who qualify under the measure, and that means that their third strike cannot have been serious or violent, and they cannot have had any very serious crimes in their past, such as murder, rape. So it's at about 1,000. That means there's roughly 2,000 left to go. It doesn't mean they'll all be released. And what we're seeing is that the first groups that went through this process were people like, you know, you heard in this program that had actually done a lot in prison, a lot of programming, and they were, in a way, sort of fast-tracked through the process. We're getting now towards harder cases, people with some serious mental illnesses, perhaps not stellar prison records, and those cases are moving more slowly. We're also obviously dealing with this issue of a lot of these people being released without any kind of supervision. And I know that some counties are looking to solutions for that. For example, Kern County just this week put two individuals who were released under the measure under local probation, local supervision. So they are going to be getting access to programs. In terms of Kern County, the numbers I got from the Public Defender's Office is that there's been 62 inmates released under the measure. Interestingly, only two were denied. So, you know, clearly most of these cases are moving forward. Now, again, that'll probably shift as we get further through. But just one point, too, is this has never been done before. There's never been a voters' initiative anywhere in the country that allowed inmates currently in prison to get out under reduced sentences. So it's new, and it's definitely an experiment, and it's clear that the measure, there were some gaps in how the measure was written, and counties like Kern are trying to figure that out.
I want to look now at the recidivism rate with these individuals. It's as a study from Stanford Law and the NAACP Legal Defense Fund says that around 2% of the 1,000 inmates that have been released have been charged with new crimes. That's significantly lower than the same population or the same time period for the general prison population of folks being released from prison. That's around 16%. Is there any indication as to why that number would be dramatically lower?
Well, the first thing to say is that it's not a long period of time, but you're right. Comparing apples to apples, it is much lower. You know, I think one obvious reason is the people who are getting out right now, this first batch, they're older. They've been in prison a long time, you know, 16, 18 years. And studies have shown pretty clearly that people tend to age out of criminality. Not everyone. But so when you look at, for example, statistics on lifers who get out, people serving, you know, just regular 25 to life sentences and getting out at 50 or 60, recidivism rates are extremely low, extremely low. So in that sense, this isn't a surprise. And as we get to these other cases, people who maybe served 12 years, maybe they're still in their 30s, I would suspect we'll see a slightly higher recidivism rate.
And with the lack of those probation programs and other programs that follow after prisoners are generally released for prison, for these individuals, is that even more important for this next group, the more difficult cases that you were talking about? Does that highlight the need for some solutions there even more so?
It does. It does indeed. You're talking about mental health issues. You're talking about, you know, a large percentage of these three strikers were drug addicts. Maybe that's not surprising. And even if they've been in prison 10 or, you know, 13 years, they're very much at risk. It's basic issues about housing, about employment, and these are issues that any felon who's getting out of prison will face. I think, you know, the argument here is that the voters of California, including the voters of Kern County, determined that, you know, something needed to be done to allow these people to get out earlier. And I think if that was the feeling behind the initiative, then the argument would be that something else should be done to give these people, you know, the support on the outside, because no one benefits if they, you know, if they commit new offenses. But there's a lot of other people getting, you know, released. We have all of realignment that's putting pressures on the jails. So, you know, the system is really under pressure right now, especially at the county level.
One last question before we go. The overall community reaction, you talked to a number of people both in Kern County and also up in Ripon and other areas. What was the general response that you were hearing from people? Because this Central Valley is where Three Strikes was born, essentially.
Right. Kern County prosecuted more three strikers for nonviolent crimes than any other county by population. I think it depends. You know, the folks you heard from up in Ripon, you know, they're very religious, they're very conservative, and yet they have this direct connection with a felon, and it changed their lives, and it changed his life. I think what they would say is that these are people, you know, these are people we should care about. And it's not simple. They do have their issues. But I think the more that there's direct contact between felons and folks on the outside, I think the more those barriers come down. And I, you know, I think that's just super important for all of us, not to treat these people as, you know, different sorts of human beings.
KQED's Michael Montgomery joining us today on Valley Edition, talking about his report on the aftermath of changes to California's three strikes law post Proposition 36. You can find more of his reporting on this issue and some interactive online features online at californiareport.org. Michael, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Valley Edition. Stay tuned. We'll be back in just a moment with New York Times columnist Timothy Egan. He's the author of the book The Worst Hard Time, about the Dust Bowl. It's the National Book Award winner. He's in Fresno tomorrow. We'll talk about the book and more in just a moment on Valley Edition.
My daddy plowed the ground and prayed that someday he might leave this rundown mortgaged Oklahoma farm. And then one day I heard my daddy saying to my mama that he had finally saved enough to go. Well, California was his dream of paradise, for he had seen pictures in a magazine that told him so. California cotton fields, where labor camps were filled with worried men with pain.
broken dream.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. The San Joaquin Valley will forever be linked with the story of the Dust Bowl, that era of depression, dust storms, and drought that brought so many from Oklahoma and nearby states in a mass migration to California and the West in search of a better life. Our next guest is one of the nation's foremost experts on the Dust Bowl. He's New York Times columnist and author Timothy Egan. His book, The Worst Hard Time, The Untold Story of Those Who Survived the Great American Dust Bowl, won the 2006 National Book Award and was also featured prominently in the 2012 Ken Burns film on the Dust Bowl. He'll be in Fresno tomorrow morning for a talk at the Sororian Theater as part of the San Joaquin Valley Town Hall Lecture Series. Timothy Egan joins us now on the phone. Timothy, welcome.
Hi, great to be with you.
Some 75 years after this period in American history, we're now seeing fewer and fewer of those who have firsthand memories of those days with us. Are those memories still fresh for people that you've talked to?
Yeah, that's really an important point, because this was the largest movement of Americans from one region to another, that is, from the Dust Bowl area, the five states of the Dust Bowl, the so-called Okies, to the Central Valley of California and parts of California. The largest movement until Hurricane Katrina came along, and this wasn't necessarily a natural disaster. The Dust Bowl was a man-caused disaster, but it was a huge movement of people. More than 1 million people left because their homes were destroyed, because the sky turned on them, because they could no longer even survive, and it was a trail of tragedy. And their stories are magnificent. I was so touched by these people and what they'd lived through. That's why I called my book The Worst Hard Time, because we'd never had a period in our history like this where everything was thrown at them, everything from the sky turning dark at noon to a Great Depression that forced some people even to give up their kids. And those folks who lived through that, some of them are still with us. Now, they were in their teens or 20s, and they're in their 90s now. So we're having them slip through the bonds of time right now, the last living witnesses, and you have in the Fresno area some of those people, a fair amount of those people, who saw the whole thing.
With the three quarters of a century that have passed since those days and the benefit of historical perspective that we have now looking back on the Dust Bowl, this is still something that resonates with a lot of people, does it not?
The interesting thing about it, and this is why I think there's been so much interest in it, we've got a huge readership for my book, and the Ken Burns documentary, which ran on PBS last year called The Dust Bowl, also generated a lot of interest in a chapter of our history that was almost forgotten. And I think the reason that people respond to it is twofold. One is it shows climate change almost as a parable on a small scale. We did change the earth. Man became a force of awful geology in the Dust Bowl. We took an area the size of Pennsylvania that was part of the greatest grassland the world had ever seen and made it unlivable. I mean, it just turned into this black and white landscape of dirt being thrown to the sky where nothing could be grown. So we did change the climate. We changed it for the worse. We changed the environment. So it's a parable in that sense. The second thing, that the takeaway lesson, the reason people are drawn to this story, is the tale of human resistance. You know, we have just gone through this terrible Great Recession, the worst in 50-some years, and it, as bad as it was, it can't hold a candle to what people went through during the Great Depression. And then you throw on top of that the environmental thing of, you know, losing your home, of people dying of dust pneumonia, of people starving, of people having everything they had be taken from them by this menace that they couldn't understand. There's that resilience. How the heck did you live through that? How could people take so much? One old-timer told me it was like the hate of all nature was thrown at us. How could people take so much and still come through it? So there's that resilience part of it as a takeaway.
A couple of months ago, we had a guest on our program from the National Steinbeck Center. They're doing a retracing the route of the fictionalized route of the Joad family from Oklahoma to Arvin, California, and the Weed Patch Camp. And they were interviewing people along the way. And the thing that struck me from that interview was just how contemporary these stories still are. The faces have changed. The names have changed. Maybe those people working in the fields are no longer from Oklahoma. They're now from Oaxaca. But so many of the stories are so similar and still so contemporary to our day today.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. And, you know, in Steinbeck's case, there's this one difference between the take I have is that Steinbeck's people, the Jode family, they were tenant farmers. And so what, you know, they had no reason to stay behind, and they just put everything on the jalopy and left, and they same reason that people always come somewhere, which is looking for opportunity, looking for some hope, looking for a newer life. The folks I spent a lot of time with owned their property, unlike Steinbeck's Jode family. They had something. They had a homestead for the first time in their life, and that was taken away from them. So they, you know, they had this horrible loss, this horrible sense of something. Now, the folks that came to California, as you know, it was a very mixed experience. Some of them were treated just terribly. The famous signs on the door that say "Okies and dogs use the back door," and we know for a fact that the California State Police, the Highway Patrol, blockaded, met them at the border and turned them around. There were signs in the Imperial Valley telling them not to come into the state. And this is a movement of fellow Americans. I mean, this wasn't like they were coming from another country. It was people moving from one state to the other. And then when they got to California, it wasn't all oranges and sunshine and promised land. A lot of them made that. They did become the American dream, but initially it was quite a difficult transition.
I was talking with someone recently who was talking about quote-unquote Okie culture, and there seems to be maybe in some areas more of an appreciation for the cultural impact of what those people brought to California when they came here during the Dust Bowl. But this person also said that they still sensed a certain resentment that she was surprised to still hear so many years later, that especially in our age when we're much more understanding today of other cultures and diversity and things, when the issue of, well, this is important because it was part of our Dust Bowl heritage, our Okie heritage, they were kind of scoffed at.
Yeah.
And
I'm glad you brought that up, because there's two things to be said on that. One is that, you know, the sort of cultural heritage of storytelling, of music, of how to look at the land, that's really important. And I went to a number of these annual meetings, both in the Central Valley and in Washington's Yakima Valley, where so-called Dust Bowl exiles, they called them exo-dusters was their name, took up root, and they brought this culture with them. They brought this fascinating cultural thing. But the negative stuff that you allude to, which some people still do today, is this term poor white trash, which is used as a derogative and thrown around quite a bit. And these people were called poor white trash even when they moved to Oklahoma. You can follow them all the way back to the Confederacy. They were Scots-Irish, blue-collar, poor, working the land folks who got drafted by the Confederacy to fight against the Union. These certainly weren't slave owners or plantation owners. They were cannon fodder who got drafted by the Confederates, rebel states, to fight against the Union. After the Civil War, they had nowhere to go, no land to return to, and eventually when we opened the Homestead Act in the early 20th century, they ended up in this middle part of the country. They did well for a while there, and then the Dust Bowl came, and then they moved a second time, these so-called poor white trash, to California and to Washington's Washington's Yakima Valley, which is the second biggest place. And some people today still are dismissive of them, and if you talk to the folks who lived through it all, again, they're very hurt by some of those negative stereotypes that people look down on them.
If you just joined us today on Valley Edition, our guest is Timothy Egan. He is the author of the book, The Worst Hard Time, The Untold Story of Those Who Survived the Great American Dust Bowl. He is speaking tomorrow morning at 10:30 at the William Saroyan Theater in Fresno as part of the San Joaquin Valley's Town Hall Lecture Series. Tell me about the process of putting together this book, the interviews that you did. What was it like to try to assemble these stories and talk to these people who lived through these events so long ago, and the genesis of this book and how it came about?
It was one of the most exhilarating things I've ever done. I mean, I've been a New York Times journalist for almost a quarter of a century, and I was kicking around the Southern Plains working on a Times series about the collapse of small-town America. You know, we used to be a farming nation. We no longer are. Certainly in the Central Valley we are, but we no longer are. Used to be, even in the 1930s, one in three people worked the land. So I would go to these little towns, and they were just all the same. They were dying. The banks were closing. The High school had long been shuttered. There was no place, no restaurant. And all that was left were really old people living out their lives on Social Security. And I'd close my notebook after hearing another sad story about the collapsing town. And somebody would say, but that's not the story of this place. And I would say, what do you mean? They'd say, the story is what happened in the dirty 30s. And so that started to pique my interest about this really untold story about this amazing group of Americans who lived through these extraordinary hard times. And as I started to gather the string and hear these tales, I initially did not believe them. I mean, people would say, you know, you could hold your hand out and at noon on a sunny day, and when one of these storms came, you couldn't see your hand in front of your face. And I thought, you know, that's just like your grandfather saying, in my day, I walked 20 miles in the snow to go to school. But I heard it time and again, and people would talk about how folks died of dust pneumonia. You know, young people, teenagers living in their high school gymnasium, which became a triage hospital by the Red Cross. I heard about throwing towels under the doors and wetting your sheets and putting them on the windows and, you know, these horror stories. And that's what piqued my interest. So I sort of became the accidental Dust Bowl historian. I mean, I'm a native of the Pacific Northwest, which is known for being green and wet and full of water. And I spent all this time hearing these amazing stories. I felt really lucky that I could have this story handed to me. Like, my metaphor is like a baton was handed from one generation to the other, because in another 10 years, there won't be anyone left who remembers in great detail the Dust Bowl. So I got kind of this wonderful thing that any seeker of history looks for, which is being able to hear a story firsthand, to look into somebody's eyes and have them tell it to you.
Here in California, all school children, or at least when I was in school, in high school, we all read The Grapes of Wrath and of course, watched the film that came shortly after the publication of the book. A few years ago, it was the Ken Burns documentary. So there has been a national interest in this story and this period of our history. But what do you think are some of the things that are left out or relatively out of the narrative, those misconceptions or things that people just didn't realize or don't realize about the Dust Bowl that are particularly interesting?
Yeah, the biggest misconception goes to what you just said about Steinbeck's book. Now, this is what happens in history sometimes, is somebody will get the first take, they'll tell a version, and that will become the accepted narrative. In this case, it was Steinbeck, Okies, packed up everything in jalopies and moved to California. Well, that was an important part of it, certainly, and a big part of it, certainly. As I said, you know, this is the largest movement of our people because of a weather disaster until Hurricane Katrina. But the historical fact, and this is where the misconception comes from, is that one in three people, more than 2 million people, didn't go anywhere. They stayed put and put up with this horrible disaster. So a million people fled, but 2 million people didn't go anywhere. So that's what I was trying to do in my book, and I think to a larger extent that's what Ken Burns tried to do in his documentary, and I worked with Ken quite closely, was that to try to look at what it was like to be at the core of this thing, to be at the epicenter of this thing, and not to look at, you know, so much what it was, because Steinbeck, again, did a magnificent job in doing the people who fled story, but we wanted to look at the, you know, what it was like to be in the middle of it all.
What sort of lessons do you think the Dust Bowl and the legacy of that era can have for us today?
You know, I think there's a really simple, obvious, and ancient lesson, which is you don't push Mother Nature too far because it will push back. Remember, this goes back to the Greeks, and it goes back to the concept of hubris. And in the Dust Bowl, they took an area that was this beautiful grassland where all these bison had grazed, where the Indians existed because of the bison. And then once they got rid of the Indians, all these cattle grazed off the grass, and you had all these cowboys. But then they came along and turned it over, wrong side up, as somebody told me in the book. And they thought they could just take this part of the earth and completely remake it. It was grassland. They made it into overturned dirt that grew wheat, and when the rains didn't come, the dirt took to the sky. And, you know, they didn't need Al Gore to tell them that they'd screwed up. They knew it. All these people told me they knew they'd pushed too far. It was sort of like nature was giving them this warning. So there's this great and recurring lesson of, you know, you can't push nature too far. You can't shape it too much in your liking because you'll have terrible consequences.
Timothy Egan. He is the author of The Worst Hard Time, The Untold Story of Those Who Survived the Great American Dust Bowl. He is speaking in Fresno tomorrow morning at 10:30 in a lecture presented by the San Joaquin Valley Town Hall Lecture Series. His book won the 2006 National Book Award, and he was also featured prominently in the Ken Burns film The Dust Bowl, which came out last year. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. I'm so looking forward to seeing everyone in Fresno.
You're listening to Valley Edition. Earlier this year, we started something called Homegrown, a virtual book club of the airways. And with the long Thanksgiving holiday coming up, we thought we'd invite Rebecca Plevin back to announce a new selection in our series. Rebecca, welcome back. What's our book?
Thanks, Joe. Our book is called What You See in the Dark, and it is a novel set in 1950s, 1960s Bakersfield. And I think it's a great book for the holidays. It's a real page-turner.
And now, this is by, as with all of the books in our series, they're either by local writers, about the Valley, or a combination of the two, and this fits both of those categories. Tell me about the author, Manuel Munoz.
That's right. Manuel Munoz is he was born in Dinuba, and he was born to a farm worker family. He worked in the fields. His parents worked in the fields. And he didn't leave the Valley until he went to Harvard University. And then he lived in New York for a while, and now he teaches in Arizona. But all of his literature has focused on the Valley. It's really his inspiration. And so he's written two other books of short stories that are also based in the Valley. And this is his first novel about the Valley.
Now, not to give away the whole book here, but this is kind of a thriller, a suspense novel, right? And it has a Hitchcock connection?
That's right. So it's a really cool connection, and I love books that sort of let you know about a piece of the history of the Valley that we wouldn't know otherwise. And it turns out that a very small section of the movie Psycho was filmed on the 99 between Bakersfield and Fresno. So he sort of used that bit of knowledge to build an entire story around it, and we get to know some characters in Bakersfield, and he also has someone called the director, which is based on Hitchcock, and he has someone called the actress, who is based on the main actress from Psycho.
Absolutely. Now, what's the deal? How can people participate in this book club? Because Thanksgiving's coming up. People have time off from work. Maybe they're traveling in the plane. They might be having some extra reading time. How can people participate?
That's right. So if you start reading this book and you have a question, if you have a comment, you can tweet us at KVPR, and we will be following the tweets. You can also connect with us via Facebook, and we would love to hear what you think of this book, any questions you have, any emotions that it drives out of you. And we will be discussing this book again on the air on December 3rd. We'll be speaking with the author. And if people have questions, we'd love to talk about those as well.
Yeah, we'd love to hear your feedback again. People can find the book at their local booksellers. I believe Russo's in Bakersfield has them and others. But you can also get it, of course, on your e-device and then read it. And then we'll be back December 3rd. Rebecca will be back and we'll talk with the author. It's our Homegrown Book Club. Again, tweet us at KVPR, and we're looking forward to that interview, Rebecca.
Thank you.
That's all for this Valley Edition. You can follow us online and on Twitter, Talk at KVPR is our email address, also on Facebook and a number of other social media sites, Instagram, Tumblr, and the like. You can also subscribe to our podcast online at kvpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. Again, talk at kvpr.org. For audio engineer Marv Allen, production and operations manager Don Weaver, Valley Edition producer Ezra David Romero, and reporter Rebecca Plevin, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians, on the web at chcf.org.